welcome to this deep dive. You sent us some fascinating material exploring arguments for the existence of God. And today we're going to really focus in on one of the foundational approaches, well, one that thinkers have grappled with for centuries, the cosmological argument.
Right.
Essentially, it tries to build a case, you know, for the reasonableness of believing in God based on the very existence of the world around us.
That's right. The cosmological argument, broadly speaking, looks at the simple fact that the universe is, and from there, reasons toward, well, the necessity of some kind of ultimate explanation.
Mm-hmm.
You shared some material that touched on other ways people argue for God. The teleological argument looking at design, the moral argument, arguments based on consciousness, religious experiences, even miracles. All fascinating, but for our deep dive today, we're putting on our laser focus.
Exactly. Our mission today is to unpack a specific and really intriguing version of the cosmological argument, the Kalam argument. It's got a rich history originating with medieval Islamic philosophers, and it centers on this compelling idea that the universe actually had a beginning.
And the Kalam argument lays out a pretty direct line of reasoning. It starts with what seems like, well, a common sense idea. That everything that begins to exist has a cause for its existence.
Okay.
Then it proposes that the universe began to exist. The logical conclusion, then, is that the universe must have a cause for its existence. We'll be exploring the ideas of thinkers like Alexander Proust and William Lane Craig, who are, you know, strong proponents of this way of thinking.
Right.
And also looking at some of the challenges raised by figures like David Hume and Wes Morrison.
Okay, so the core of our deep dive is to really get into the nuts and bolts of this first cause idea. What does it even mean? What are the arguments in its favor? And what are the biggest questions and challenges that come up? We want to explore this in a way that's clear, makes sense, and doesn't feel like a philosophy textbook exploded in your ears.
Mm.
So let's jump in. The first big question seems to be, does the cosmos even need an explanation in the first place?
This brings us to a really fundamental principle in philosophy known as the principle of sufficient reason. Alexander Proust articulates it as, all contingently true propositions have explanations.
Okay, contingently true.
Now, contingently true is a crucial concept here. Think of something that is true, but it could have easily been otherwise. For instance, if there's a book on your table, that's true, but you can easily imagine your table without that book. It's contingent.
Right. It's different from saying something like, all bachelors are unmarried. That's a necessary truth. It simply cannot be false by definition.
Exactly.
The universe itself, the fact that it exists at all, feels like a contingent thing. It's not hard to imagine a state where the universe simply wasn't.
Mm.
So, the principle of sufficient reason says that this contingent fact, the universe's existence, calls for an explanation. And if we reject this, it's not just about the universe. It potentially undermines the very foundation of how we understand cause and effect in our daily lives and in scientific inquiry.
Absolutely.
It opens the door to accepting random, inexplicable events as fundamental, which is, well, a radical shift in perspective.
Exactly. But this is where David Hume, a real philosophical heavyweight, throws a curveball. He famously questioned whether we can even conceive of the universe just popping into being without any cause whatsoever, ex nihilo, as it's often called.
Right, out of nothing.
If we can imagine it, he suggested, maybe it's actually possible, and therefore the universe might not actually require an explanation.
But Proust has a pretty strong counter to that, doesn't he? He basically argues that when we think we're picturing something appearing out of thin air, we might be fooling ourselves.
Yeah, how so?
He suggests it's a kind of self-deception to think we can truly imagine a complete absence of any causal influences leading to the sudden appearance of something. It's almost like a blind spot in our imaginative capabilities.
Precisely. Proust argues that our everyday experiences strongly support the principle of sufficient reason. Think about it. If you wake up and find your car has a flat tire, do you just shrug and say, well, I guess it just happened for no reason?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
You immediately start searching for a cause, a nail, a slow leak, maybe vandalism.
Exactly. And the same applies if you notice money missing from your wallet. You don't assume it vanished spontaneously. You look for an explanation. It's just how our minds are wired. You know, we're constantly seeking causes for the effects we observe.
Mm-hmm.
And Proust points out that denying this principle would really pull the rug out from under a huge amount of our knowledge, especially in science. I mean, the entire scientific endeavor is built on the assumption that events have causes and that we can discover those causes.
It's fundamental to how we make sense of the world. So, okay, if we accept that the cosmos does need an explanation, the next logical step is to ask, could there be an explanation that doesn't involve a first cause?
Right.
And this is where things get even more interesting. So one possibility is this idea of a non-causal ultimate explanation. Maybe there are just some fundamental metaphysical principles or ultimate cosmic laws that explain why the universe exists without needing an actual cause in the traditional sense.
Proust is quite critical of this idea. He argues that principles and laws are really just descriptive formulas. They tell us how things behave, but they don't possess any causal power in themselves. Take the law of gravity, for example. It describes how objects with mass attract each other, but it doesn't explain why this attraction happens or what the underlying mechanism is. Think of it like a recipe describing how to bake a cake. The recipe doesn't make the cake. It's just a set of instructions.
That's a great way to put it. The law of gravity is like the instructions, but it's not the actual force doing the work.
Exactly. So the key takeaway here is that laws describe, they don't act.
So Proust's point is that these principles or laws can't be the ultimate explanation for the universe's existence because they're not agents. They're not entities that can make something happen.
Right. And the other main alternative to a first cause is the idea of a beginningless chain of non-ultimate causes, famously championed by David Hume again.
Okay, Hume's back.
He suggested that maybe every contingent being has a cause that is itself another contingent being, and this chain simply stretches back infinitely. In this scenario, you don't need a first uncaused cause to get the ball rolling.
So it's like a never-ending line of dominoes. Each domino knocks over the next one, and the line just goes on forever.
Mm-hmm.
Every domino has a cause, the one before it, so you don't need to ask what started the whole thing.
But Proust has a compelling rebuttal to this. He uses the analogy of a cannonball in flight. You can explain the ball's position at any given moment by its position in the previous moment and so on, but that doesn't explain the flight of the cannonball at all. What propelled it in the first place?
Right.
What explains the entire chain of events, the very fact that the cannonball is flying? A beginningless series of contingent causes, Proust argues, doesn't actually answer the ultimate question of origin. It just pushes the explanation further back without ever providing a real starting point.
Okay, so if we're leaning towards the idea that there must be a first cause, the next big hurdle is what Proust calls the gap problem.
Right, the gap.
How do we bridge the gap from simply saying there's a first cause to saying that first cause is actually God, especially the God of classical theism?
Yeah.
You know, all powerful, all knowing, outside time and space.
This is where the Kalam argument makes a specific and interesting move. Its proponents argue that the ultimate explanation for the cosmos can't just be some impersonal mechanistic force. It has to be a personal being.
Why?
Well, because a mechanistic cause, they argue, only operates when the necessary conditions are in place. If the cause of the universe were purely mechanistic, and those conditions were always there,
then the universe would have always existed, right?
Exactly. But the Kalam argument posits that the universe began to exist.
That makes sense intuitively.
Yeah.
If the cause was just a set of physical laws that were always in effect,
mm-hmm.
why would the universe have a start date? It would just be eternally.
Nice.
So the argument is that the first cause must have had a will, a choice, an intention to bring the universe into being, which points towards a personal agent.
So thinking back to the sources you shared, this argument from Proust directly addresses the intuition that something doesn't just pop into existence for no reason.
Right.
And from this, Kalam defenders deduce certain attributes of this first cause. It would have to be incredibly powerful, obviously, to create the entire universe.
Makes sense.
It would have to be atemporal and immutable because it existed before time and change, as we know them, began with the universe. And it would have to be extremely intelligent, perhaps omniscient, to conceive and bring about such a complex reality.
Okay.
When you put all these characteristics together, powerful, timeless, unchanging, intelligent, immanent, it does start to sound a lot like the traditional concept of God, classical theism.
Now, Proust also touched on this idea of constitutive explanations as an alternative. Could we explain the universe by pointing to its own components without needing an external cause? Like explaining heat as the kinetic energy of molecules.
Right, that's another angle. But Proust's response is that even constitutive explanations aren't truly ultimate. We can always ask why those components exist in that particular state. Why does the knife have high kinetic energy?
Right.
Because someone heated it.
Okay, there's still a cause behind the state.
Exactly. So even if we explain the universe by its fundamental particles and forces, we can still ask, where did those come from? What explains their existence and their specific properties? ultimately, Proust argues, we're led back to a causal explanation.
Okay, so we've talked about whether the cosmos needs an explanation and whether that explanation could avoid a first cause. Now we get to one of the central pillars of the Kalam argument. The claim that the universe actually began to exist.
Yes, a huge point.
This is where William Lane Craig steps in with some pretty strong arguments.
Absolutely. Craig offers both philosophical and scientific arguments for a finite past. His first philosophical argument centers on the idea that an actual infinite series cannot exist.
The infinite library.
Yeah, he uses this really thought-provoking analogy of an infinitely long shelf of library books where every other book is blue and every other is red.
Uh-huh.
The puzzle is that if you have an infinite number of books total, you also have an infinite number of blue books. So half of infinity seems to equal infinity.
Which clashes with our basic intuition that a part should be smaller than the whole, right?
Precisely. Craig argues that this kind of contradiction shows the very idea of an actual infinite series is incoherent. If the past were actually infinite, you'd run into these kinds of paradoxes.
But not everyone agrees with Craig's reasoning here. Thinker Wes Morriston raises some significant challenges to this idea of the impossibility of an actual infinite.
Indeed. Morriston challenges this by pointing out that Craig's argument relies on what's called Euclid's maxim, the idea that a whole is greater than any of its proper subsets.
Okay.
Morriston argues that this maxim might only apply to finite sets, and when you're dealing with infinity, different rules might apply. It's like, maybe our finite intuitions just don't work there. He even brings up the example of a finite chunk of space, which can be infinitely divided into smaller and smaller regions, suggesting an infinite number of subregions within a finite space.
And Craig's counter to the space argument is that it only shows that space is potentially infinitely divisible, not that there are actually an infinite number of divisions existing right now.
Right, potential versus actual.
Think of it like this. You could potentially divide a cake into an infinite number of slices, but in reality, you'll stop at some finite point. The question Craig is raising is whether the past is like an actually infinite cake already sliced, or if it's a process of slicing that has gone on for a very long but finite time.
But Morriston comes back saying that you can't have potential divisibility without the existing regions to divide in the first place. It's a real back and forth on this complex concept of infinity.
Yeah, it really is. There's a historical philosophical discomfort with the concept itself, with thinkers wrestling with its paradoxical nature for centuries.
Definitely. Craig's second philosophical argument is that a collection formed by adding one member after another cannot be actually infinite.
Okay, how does that work?
The idea here is that if the past were infinite, it would mean an infinite number of events have been added sequentially, one after the other, to reach the present moment. But Craig argues, you can't traverse an actual infinite. It would be like trying to count to infinity, you'd never reach the end, right? So you could never reach the present moment if you had to cross an infinite past.
Interesting. So you can't complete an infinite sequence by successive addition.
That's the argument. But Morriston's main pushback here is that this argument might not apply if the universe had no temporal beginning. If it's truly eternal, then the series of events wasn't formed by sequentially adding one after another from a starting point. It just is.
Okay. So the argument only works if you assume a starting point from which you're adding.
That seems to be Morriston's critique, yes. Then we move to Craig's scientific argument, which leans heavily on Big Bang cosmology.
Right, the science.
The observation of the redshift in light from distant galaxies, which Edwin Hubble famously discovered, strongly suggests that the universe is expanding. Everything is moving further and further apart, like dots on an inflating balloon.
And if you run that expansion in reverse.
Exactly. You get to a point where all the matter and energy in the universe would have been compressed into an incredibly small, dense state, the initial singularity of the Big Bang.
Which strongly suggests a finite beginning for the universe, somewhere in the ballpark of, what, 12 to 14 billion years ago?
Around that, yes. And the vast majority of cosmologists today agree that the universe as we know it had this kind of beginning. The evidence from cosmic microwave background radiation, element abundances, it all points towards the Big Bang model.
So the scientific consensus is pretty strong in a beginning.
It is. But Morriston acknowledges the strong scientific consensus, but argues that it shows a high degree of likelihood, not absolute certainty. Science is always open to revision based on new evidence, right?
True. Always provisional.
He also brings up the possibility, even if it's not currently the prevailing view, of an oscillating universe with cycles of expansion and contraction that could potentially go on infinitely, or maybe other pre-Big Bang scenarios.
So While the Big Bang provides compelling evidence for a beginning, it might not be the absolute final, incontrovertible word on the matter, philosophically speaking.
That's Morriston's point. It's strong evidence, but maybe not definitive proof against an eternal universe in some form.
Okay, so if we accept that the universe likely had a beginning, we're back to the first premise of the Kalam argument. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. Craig doesn't spend as much time defending this because it's generally less contested than the idea of the universe having a beginning.
Yeah, it feels more intuitive, maybe.
The intuitive reason for this premise is strong. We just don't observe things popping into existence out of nowhere without any cause. It's so ingrained in our experience. Think about when you were a kid and constantly asked why after everything.
Exactly. Craig uses the simple but effective example of a tiger suddenly appearing in this room. It's absurd. It violates our fundamental understanding of how the world works.
Right. No magic tigers.
And if it seems absurd for a relatively small, complex object like a tiger, it seems even more absurd to think the entire universe, with all its complexity and vastness, could just spontaneously appear uncaused.
Morriston's counter here, though, is that our experience of things like tigers coming into being doesn't necessarily apply to something as unique and all-encompassing as the universe.
The uniqueness objection.
Yeah. We don't have repeated observations of universes coming into being to draw firm conclusions. It's a sample size of one, essentially.
That's a fair point to raise. But as Craig would likely respond, the principle of causality seems so fundamental to our understanding of reality at every other level that it's hard to see why it would suddenly break down when we talk about the universe as a whole. It would be special pleading, maybe.
Okay, so it's a burden of proof thing why I assume causality stops applying.
Kind of, yeah. Which leads us back to the question. Must this first cause be a person? Craig argues that because mechanical causes only operate when the conditions are right, and if the universe had a beginning, its cause couldn't have been purely mechanistic and always in effect.
Right, we covered that. If it was mechanical and always there, no beginning.
Therefore, the cause must be personal, possessing a will and the ability to choose to bring the universe into existence at a specific point, even if that point is the beginning of time itself.
And this personal first cause, as we discussed earlier, would have to have some pretty impressive qualities. Immense power, intentionality, intelligence, and the ability to make choices.
Yeah.
It starts to paint a picture that aligns with the concept of a personal God. So if the cosmological argument suggests a powerful creator, listeners who have explored the teleological argument might find that it resonates with the evidence of design in the universe.
Right. You can see how these arguments can potentially link up.
Leading to further questions about the nature and intentions of this creator.
But Morriston raises a significant and valid challenge here. How exactly does a spirit god will and bring about a physical universe?
The interaction problem.
Yeah. It's a conceptual hurdle, no doubt. How does an immaterial being interact with and create the material realm? We don't have a clear mechanism for that.
It's definitely a mind-bending question, one that philosophers and theologians have wrestled with for centuries. How does the non-physical affect the physical?
Exactly. But as Craig would likely argue, the fact that we don't have a complete understanding of the precise mechanism doesn't negate the conclusion that there must be a transcendent, powerful, and intelligent cause to explain the universe's beginning. The difficulty in explaining how doesn't refute that.
Okay, so the conclusion stands even if the mechanism is mysterious.
That would be the counterargument. Finally, we need to address the classic objection often leveled against the cosmological argument. If everything needs a cause, what caused God?
Yes, the who created the creator question always comes up.
It's frequently used to try and undermine the entire line of reasoning, suggesting it leads to an infinite regress anyway, or that it's self-contradictory.
So how does someone like Proust handle that?
Proust addresses this by suggesting that God's choice to create stems from his own values and aims, which are inherent to his very nature. God, as a necessary being, unlike the contingent universe, doesn't begin to exist, so the first premise, everything that begins to exist has a cause, doesn't apply to God.
So the premise is specifically about things that begin. God, being eternal, didn't begin.
That's the key distinction. God is argued to be the uncaused cause, the necessary foundation upon which contingent reality rests. We might need special revelation, like scripture, to fully grasp God's motivations, but ultimately the explanation lies in who God is, a necessary being whose nature explains itself.
Okay.
And Proust makes a crucial point that affirming the principle of sufficient reason doesn't necessarily mean we have to have a complete and exhaustive explanation for absolutely everything right now.
Right.
We can know that something has a cause without knowing all the intricate details of why or how. He uses a helpful analogy. Think of Leonardo da Vinci painting the Mona Lisa. We know he painted it, even if we don't know all of his motivations or every single brushstroke he made in the process.
That's a good analogy. We know the cause, da Vinci, even without perfect knowledge of the process or reasons.
Similarly, proponents argue, we can affirm that God created the universe even if we don't fully understand all the reasons or the precise mechanics involved. Knowing that there's an explanation isn't the same as knowing the entire explanation.
So to wrap up this deep dive, we've journeyed through the cosmological argument, focusing specifically on the Kalam version, which asks whether the universe's existence necessitates a first cause.
Mm-hmm.
We've considered the arguments for why the cosmos might need an explanation, the challenges to the idea of an infinite regress of causes, the debate over whether the universe actually had a beginning, based on both philosophical reasoning and scientific evidence.
Right, the philosophical and scientific angles.
And the line of thought suggesting that this first cause might be a personal being with attributes we often associate with God.
We've encountered a variety of perspectives, from the strong defenses put forth by Priest and Craig to the insightful critical questions raised by Hume and Morriston. It's clear that this is a deeply complex and enduring philosophical debate.
Absolutely.
That continues to spark intellectual discussion and doesn't offer easy, straightforward answers.
And that brings us to our final thought for you, the listener. Considering all the arguments we've unpacked today, what really sticks with you? What do you find most compelling or perhaps most challenging about the idea of a first cause for the universe?
Yeah, what resonates?
And what kind of explanation, if any, do you think ultimately best addresses the profound mystery of existence itself? It's a lot to contemplate, and we encourage you to keep exploring these fascinating and fundamental questions.
Thank you for sharing your sources with us and for joining us on this deep dive into a truly fundamental area of philosophical thought.